you're listening to a track from Canadian artist Kai Basanta. This is a song called ESP from Kai's 2018 EP, Earth.
Oh, I have to get my Lake Magog vaccine.
Your Lake Magog vaccine?
Yeah, you know, I'm really looking forward to having the whole family to the cottage for my annual cookout.
Smart move. I'm gonna ask for the Montreal vaccine. I miss those last-minute get-togethers with my buddies.
Nice. Well, I gotta run. I don't think it protects against lateness.
Each vaccination brings us closer to these moments. Follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book an appointment at quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome to Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal's only queer culture show that bridges any divide between queer sex and radical queer politics. Due to the fabulous nature of queer experience, tonight's program may contain sexually explicit or coarse language. You've been advised. Welcome to the May 24th edition of Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 in Montreal, Jajage. As promised last week, we're back with new material this week. On today's show, I sat down with two friends who are both Jewish and queer, Vi and Jared, to speak about their relationship with the Jewish faith and their support of Palestinian liberation amidst the ongoing ethnic cleansing by the Zionist project of the Israeli state towards Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah, Gaza, and the occupied West Bank. I hope you enjoy both of these conversations.
My name is Vi Levitt. I use their, them, their pronouns, and I am a musician, artist, and activist currently based on the unceded Musqueam territories in Vancouver, BC, and soon to be located on unceded Mohawk territory in Diodiaga or Montreal. I am an Ashkenazi and Sephardic Jew, and I was raised in a conservative Jewish household, and I was raised, at least for the first half of my life, via a system influenced heavily by Hasbara, meaning the Israeli state-sponsored campaign to support Israel and to make sure other people support Israel. I attended a Jewish day school for my primary source of education until grade 3, and attended a pro-Israel synagogue until I was 13. I grew up almost entirely kosher. I didn't have any bit of pork that I knew of or shellfish until I was 13 or 14, excuse me, and I did not decide to willingly stop being someone who follows kashrut laws until around that time. Conveniently around then, I was also coming into my identity as a queer person more and coming into my idea as a queer Jewish person. And so that led to, I wouldn't say naturally, but with the landscape of Jewish culture in North America, especially Jewish Ashkenazi culture, which is the primary culture of it, naturally that leads to a discourse involving Palestine and involving Israel. When I was growing up, it wasn't a question to support Israel. Our synagogue had tzedakah campaigns. That's a campaign of charity where everything would go to the Jewish National Fund, the JNF being the primary method in which Jews, before the founding of Israel and after the founding of Israel, purchased land for Jewish settlement in Palestine, and continues to do so in the West Bank and Gaza, at least until the ceasefire in 2006 in the Oslo Accords. So it was guaranteed that you were supposed to support Israel. I don't remember really any dissenting voices until I had actively stopped attending synagogue. But growing up, it was Israel or bust. I grew up expecting to go to the State of Israel, to go and work on a kibbutz or do other things. And around the time that I was like coming to my own queerness, I came into contact with pinkwashing campaigns, whether that's via the Vancouver Queer Film Festival showing Israeli films about queerness in Israel, you know, through the lens of Israel is the only place in the Middle East that likes queer people, even though that's not true, and there's thriving queer communities both before and after the founding of Israel in Arab states and non-Arab states in the Middle East. But there are movies like Habua that I looked at, Habua meaning the bubble, about like how apparently, and I apologize for using the word, but apparently savage the Palestinian community is with gay people and how accepting Israel is, even though Israel as a state abuses and uses queer people in Palestine in order to further their agenda by blackmailing often Palestinian queer men at the threat of outing them to their family to spy for Israel. So growing up and growing up queer, I assumed I would move to Israel. I assumed I would go there. I assumed I would join the army. And I didn't think about Palestinians because Palestinians didn't exist to us. When I was growing up, the narrative was Jews are from historic Palestine. And because we are from there, no matter how far back, we have a right to that land. That land is ours. I don't remember even hearing the word Palestinian until or Arab really in any of my classes about Israel or Jewishness until about, second grade, roughly around then. I can roughly remember it, and it being a lesson about why we must defend ourselves as Jews, why, why as in like, why must we defend ourselves? Not like why as in the reason, why as in like the questioning, because Jewishness, how I was raised, is all about questioning things. It's all about achieving knowledge. So why are we a persecuted people? Why is it in our own, quote unquote, our own state, we are still persecuted by the Arabs around us? Why are we targeted by the UN? And I ate that shit up. Apologies for swearing, but I ate that up. And I remember there being a period when I was about 13, 14, where I really ate it up. Like, I didn't know any Palestinians. I didn't know any Arabs. They were the ones who teased me at school for being openly queer. So my brain immediately thought Arabs, homophobia, that means Israel, they're right. And so I remember thinking, what is a Palestinian right to territory? Palestinians didn't exist. I didn't think Palestine exists ever or has been, because that's how I was taught. It was terra nullis. There is no one living there. And if there were there, then there are interlopers, just how colonizers in Europe viewed North America before colonization. And I wouldn't say it took a lot to counter that, because it was really one moment for me. So my mother, she married a Orthodox Israeli man, and for a while I was exposed to both Orthodox Israeli culture and also the conservative Jewish culture that I was raised in. And Avigdor Lieberman, the former defense minister of Israel and also the leader of one of Israel's largest Soviet representing groups, Aliyah meaning the move to Israel by the diaspora, and he was visiting to talk to people at JCC, to talk about Palestine, to talk about Israel, and to talk about why Jews must support the Israeli state. And my stepdad said, hey, you like protests, you like activism, come to this protest with me. And he wrote a sign in Hebrew that translated to English, and I don't speak Hebrew. I used to as a kid, but not at this point, and I still don't. So he had this sign that said, holy city is whole city. Holy city is whole city, not as in like a whole city occupied by Jews, but rightfully owned by Jewish people, not in control of the UN or by Palestinians. And I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what the sign meant. I was just carrying it because I was like, oh, it's something for peace, because he knows that I'm trying to be neutral, because at that time I was trying to be neutral. And so we go there and I see a group of Palestinian protesters and pro-Palestine protesters, and I see a bunch of Jews. And I see the Jewish people from the Orthodox school, and they're like people my age. So I go and talk to them. I'm like, hey, what's happening? They're like, blah, 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 blah. We're having a nice conversation about this, because to them it was an intellectual exercise. So they're sitting there, they're standing there, and they're talking with Palestinians and Arabs. And these are like kids who are like 14. And you see this a lot with kids on the right, or kids in 4chan circles, or that part of the internet where it's just smug. And they were saying, they were saying things like, yes, you know, like you are Arabs, but like this is a Jewish territory. God has given it to us, and it's like this. And just in the most condescending way. And I was like, this doesn't seem right to me. And so I remember going up to people and being like, hey, do you mind if we have a conversation about this? I'm kind of on the fence. I don't really know what's happening. And this one woman told me what my sign says. And I said, what the hell? So I throw my sign away, my Zionist sign, and I just start talking to people. And I ran into an organizer who I would later become friends with, Amal Rana, who is a Pakistani Jewish mixed race femme organizer who runs Queers Against Israeli Apartheid Vancouver. And while I haven't been involved because of COVID lately, my running into Amal really shaped my identity as an anti-Zionist, because they addressed me as an adult, as a person, in a way that I hadn't been addressed by the Jewish community at that date. Usually when I would talk about this, I'd be like, what about Palestinians? What about Arabs? Because I was curious. They would shut me down and say, the Arabs are interlopers. The Syrians tried to wipe us out. The Yom Kippur War was an accident, or it wasn't an accident, apologies. The Yom Kippur War was a surprise, and they're trying to wipe us into the sea. And so I talked to them, and I talked to the other people in Queers Against Israeli Apartheid Vancouver, and I said, like, I don't understand, because I'm a queer person, I'm a gay person, like, don't Arabs not like gay people? Isn't the only place that is safe for gay people in the Middle East Israel? And they looked at me and they said, no, that's pinkwashing. Or that wasn't a term that they used at the time, but that was what I later became familiar with, the term, that it was pinkwashing, that queer people on both sides of the border, of the border fence in Israel, in the West Bank, in Gaza, if they are Palestinian, they are viewed as a tool by the Israeli state, and that in their own communities, they are just as likely to face love and support as they are in the Jewish communities. And that really was mind-blowing for me, because I didn't realize, one, I didn't know that Arab people did support queer people. I didn't know that Arab people didn't hate Jews. I didn't know all these things, because these are the things that were taught to me. I was taught that Arabs, the Arab lands were bare. It was barren, there was nothing there, and the Jews came and made our land green again. And so whenever I would imagine poverty, I would imagine Palestine, I would imagine Saudi Arabia, I would imagine Iraq, I would imagine all these places, because that is what barren meant to me. Barren meant Arab. And so that was kind of the first moment where I found the term pinkwashing. I was familiar with it. I was familiar with what it could do. And moving forward, my interactions with the Jewish community changed. People were more hostile to me because I questioned Israel and I questioned Palestine. People were more upfront about their disappointment with my choosing to support a colonized people, because of the Holocaust, because I'd grown up knowing people in my family that had survived. My father had told me stories of people with tattoos on their arms with numbers. I grew up with the Holocaust always in my brain, because that is what happened, and that is going to happen again unless we can secure safety for the Jewish people. And that meant Israel. Ignoring the Jewish labor bunt movement in the early 20th century that was supporting Jews where they were, that the diaspora deserved safety, the rejection of Zionism wasn't something I considered until I was familiar with actual people in real life that were Jewish, that were from mixed ethnicities, mixed backgrounds, a variety of backgrounds, and that they could look me right in the eye and address me as an adult and as a person and say, you have been misinformed. And not knowing how to deal with my community being hostile, I searched for help elsewhere. I read books about Islam, about Arab artists and poets like Khalil Gibran, and that's really stereotypical that I go for the most popular ones, but I did. And then I remember attending queer summer camp when I was about 15. It was camp out. It was one of the years before COVID and before a lot of restructuring happened. And I met a friend of mine who I still consider dear Nai. And Nai and I, we bonded over the cultural similarities that we shared, because as a Jewish person in a diaspora, I am familiar with music that sounds like Arab music, that uses similar modes of construction and scales. So when we would talk about things, I would talk about, oh, hey, blah, 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 Arab artist, here is a Jewish artist that I know of. And, you know, at the time that I met Nai, I was still regarding myself as like a lost Israeli or like a soon to be Israeli. And then when they told me they were Palestinian, I was like, whoa. Like, that knowledge that I had gained about pink washing could be corroborated by a person, and a person in real life, and a person who showed me way more patience than I deserved, because of the way that I thought of Islam, the way that I thought of Arab people, was a condescending view, because I was taught to condescend or to deny their existence. And here was someone who was, again, showing me immense patience and immense like care and love. And I broke out of my stupor. I couldn't see what was happening to our communities, how the money that we are raising that doesn't go into our communities, it goes to Israel, it goes to funding a war machine, and it goes to funding the oppression of a people who we had lived beside peacefully for hundreds of thousands of years, hundreds/thousands of years. There had always been Jewish people in Palestine, yes, but there had also always been other people. There had been Phoenicians, there have been Arabs, there have been so many other people. There have been Armenians, Assyrians. There is a melting pot in the Middle East, in Jerusalem, that is erased by Israel's existence because Israel wants to replace it with a white supremacist state, that being a white Jewish supremacist state, specifically Ashkenazi Jewish supremacist state. And throughout my, you know, young adult life, my late teens and coming into my 20s that I'm in now, I've been reading more and more about the truth of Israel, about how, you know, how it has treated the Ethiopian Jews, the Beta Israel and the Bnei Israel from India, how it's treated converts, how it treats the Ugandan Jews who recently applied for the right for birthright or the right for Aliyah and were denied by the high rabbinate because they weren't deemed Jewish enough. And it's wild to me that a religion where we had been oppressed for thousands of years, we've been treated terribly for thousands of years. This is, you know, the narrative that I was taught. The Germans tried to wipe us out. The English wanted to get rid of us, blah, 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 blah. It will treat not people, it will treat other Jews with the same hostility that the Germans treated us. When I hear about what happens in Israel with the Ethiopian Jewish community, about how they are at higher risk of police violence, at their higher risk of violence from the state, the same way that Black people are treated here in Canada and here in America and in the rest of Europe and any other state that is built on settler colonialism, it draws the direct conclusion that Israel is continuing the same settler colonial policies. And that's not something that I can deny anymore. It's a matter of Israel supposedly likes queer people, even though queer people can't legally get married in Israel because no rabbi is legally allowed by the high rabbinate to perform Jewish religious ceremonies to wed people. And sidebar, in Israel, you can't get married via civil means. You have to get married via a religious means. And it doesn't matter if supposedly they recognize queer people or if Tel Aviv is like the hot place for the muscle gays from Europe to do cocaine and party. Like there isn't liberation in a state that is actively racist against our Jewish communities. There isn't liberation in a state that shits on Ethiopian Jews, that shits on Persian Jews, and makes you address yourself in a way that isn't how you are. I've talked to people from Israel and they're like, you know, sure, we don't have nuclear weapons. Sure, we don't have all these things. It's always, sure, we don't have these things because what do you do? Just what do you do when a state is about you, supposedly, a Jewish nation state, and it's just built on the same things as everything else? I was talking to my father a while ago, and he's getting old, and I was like, this is before the violence. And I was like, do you want to visit the Wailing Wall before you die? And she said yes. And I was like, at a certain point, I would like to too, but I can't, because there's no way that I can set foot in this land that, you know, supposedly was for the Jews, supposedly is territory that Jews can enter, because our religion isn't built on blood. Our religion isn't built on revenge, but that's what Israel seems to be based on entirely. They talk about how in retaliation for Hamas rockets, they destroyed apartment complexes. And that's not what we were taught to do. That's not how our religion is supposed to be. That's not how our culture is supposed to be. We have been mourning a temple being destroyed thousands of years ago, but people will still dance and laugh over Al-Aqsa Mosque burning. It just doesn't make sense. And it's unconscionable. Sorry, that was a real tangent.
Thank you so much for, you know, providing your experience. I think it's super valuable. I think a lot of things came up for me. Firstly, you mentioned Vancouver Queer Film Festival. I don't think the people there have really done the work to address the damage that they caused years ago with that film festival. They kind of just skipped over it.
I feel the same way.
And, we're coming up on June, Pride Month across so-called North America. And I don't know what's going on with the Vancouver Queer Film Festival, if they're planning on doing another digital year or something like that. But I think, firstly, I think what's going on all over the world, you know, what happened with the murder of George Floyd, has kind of been amplified by the fact that we're all in a global pandemic, and, we're all on our smartphones a lot more than we normally were. Mm-hmm. And I think it is allowing people to kind of open their eyes to things that they were unaware of before. And so it will be interesting as we kind of go into Pride Month to see, you know, what are going to be the responses of, you know, queer organizations, queer parties that are supposedly like, you know, for human rights. You know, a ceasefire was declared. Israel has not been actually respecting the terms of the ceasefire. And so, we continue to protest and we continue to show up in ways. So yeah, I'm just thinking about how organizations like the Vancouver Queer Film Festival, if they would respond, maybe this is like an opportune moment for them to finally kind of come to terms with their history. I'm not sure.
I am skeptical. I would hope that they do that, because as you're right, we're on our phones way more, and it's really exposed people to the ridiculous way in which our communities will allow the state of Israel to, or even other communities that are in support of Israel, such as the American Christian communities, the Jewish communities in North America, how we'll allow them to do what they do and to be as filled with vitriol and misinformation as possible. Like, you know, doing this interview, I'm kind of like uncomfortable with the idea of other Jewish people hearing it and then being like, this person's a self-hating Jew. There are literally lists for people like that. And it's just really unfortunate that that's happening in our own communities, that people will refuse to talk about it, that people will refuse to sit down and listen to other communities. But then it's also amazing that you go on your phone and you can see the immense resiliency and power of the Palestinian community, and how artists will go out of their way to be like, this is what is happening. We mean nothing. We mean nothing bad for Jewish people. And they will, but this is what's happening to us. Like, there's a DJ based in Ramallah. Her name is Sama Abdul Hadi. She was on Boiler Room Palestine, and she's been sharing everything that's been happening. And she still takes time to be like, this is not about anti-Semitism. If you are anti-Semitic, you do not belong in the anti-Zionist movement. And that's just that level of care that they have to take, and that they choose to take, is amazing. And really, like, because we're on our phones so much, we're really able to see the kindness that the Palestinian community is showing to Jews while also expressing their immense pain. And it's just, there's just so much that is wrong with our communities if we see that and we don't take action.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's interesting because in regards to pinkwashing, you know, like how the Israeli state has used like a pro-LGBT image to advance its expansion and its narrative and like its hold on the region of historical Palestine and present-day Palestine. You know, of course, in like radical queer communities for decades, there has been conversations going on about countering this narrative. So it's not something that's new, but I feel like we are still entering perhaps into a time where it is more commonplace to speak out against the like propaganda and perhaps draw parallels. You know, like it is very similar, Israeli state propaganda and how it kind of like moves through youth, like through Orthodoxy and like more conservative strains of Judaism, to like, you know, Christian, like radical right-wing evangelical Christianism, where like Christianity, you know, where it's indoctrinating kids and promoting conversion therapy to say that like gay is not okay. I just really hope, I mean, like so much of our discourse exists in this like online, not only because like, you know, our smartphones are such a part of our lives, but also because we have been isolated through this global pandemic. I hope that both online and in more physical spaces that we're able to talk more openly and more critically about this, what's going on.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that our communities, not to, you know, zone in specifically at the Vancouver Queer Film Festival, but to bring them up again, it's interesting
let's bring them up.
Okay, it's funny and ironic how organizations in queer communities will address decolonization in Canada, but they won't address decolonizing in Palestine. There's been a lot of intention for reconciliation to try and address, you know, the indigenous question in LGBT spaces, in queer spaces, but they haven't been addressing the Palestine question. So if land back is something that is going to happen here, land back is something that also needs to happen in Palestine. And I don't think that the Queer Film Festival in Vancouver or many other places is willing to make that connection. And, you know, that affects their budget, that affects their sponsorships. And it's just like, why are you here if you aren't going to do the work?
Yeah. And I mean, they're probably approaching land back in a quite like neoliberal, like decolonizing framework of like, we need to decolonize our like theaters and we need to decolonize our workshops, you know, and not so much like we need to give it back, you know, and like,
yeah,
where the money that's being generated through the film festival, like where does it come from, where is it going, right? It's they're not like an anti-capitalist, anti-colonial organization, right? We need more grassroots queer. I would love to see a grassroots queer film festival in Vancouver. As you know, Vancouver loses really great queers yearly because it's such an unaffordable city to live in and
like
to,
me,
you know, really, yeah, really live in and survive in, right?
It would be nice if a situation like that, if something like that would appear in Vancouver. I would like to see if that exists in Montreal, but I also would like to see if it exists in a space that isn't, so controlling. I find that a lot of spaces in Vancouver tend to, you know, be like that because they're trying to protect what they have. So there's a lot of anger, but it would be really, really good to see those spaces in Vancouver again. Because they did exist. They just don't need more because everyone moved to Edmonton and Montreal.
Yeah, or Denman Island or something like that.
Or Denman Island, yeah.
Vi, thank you so much for coming on here. Any closing remarks that you want to share?
From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free does not mean that the Jews will be wiped out. It means that stewardship of the land will go back to those who were there before and continue to be there. And I think that is something that is a miscommunication, a purposeful miscommunication on behalf of Zionist communities.
Yeah, and I mean, that exists here too, right? Like on May Day, May 1st, I had a conversation with some like Marxist-Leninist leaning people, and they were like promoting this idea of like a social or like workers' revolution in Canada as being the only way to overthrow capitalism. And I was like, well, it's not really like our decision. Like, and I don't really believe in like that type of revolution on like stolen land. And they got very reactionary, right? And which is a common settler anxiety is like, where are we going to go? Like, we come from like a diversity of backgrounds. We can't like split ourselves up and like go back to places. And it's just like, chill out. You know, like
if you actually talk to Indigenous people, any Indigenous community will most likely tell you, we don't want to get rid of every settler. We want you to respect the territory you are on and our right to custodianship.
Yeah, governance, yeah. Self-governance and like sovereignty. I mean, the Canadian state's never going to do that because they're like an extractive entity, right?
Yeah.
Well, Vi, thank you so much. I will be seeing you in Montreal. I'll to have you on QueerCore again. Yeah?
Yeah, I look forward to it.
Hi, my name is Jared, and I'm a queer musician living in Montreal who identifies as Jewish. I've been living in Montreal for about 3 years now, and it's been a great experience within relationship to my Jewish identity, because it's not really something I've had access to in other parts of the world I've lived in. I'm really excited about being here in Montreal and being a queer person in Canada. Montreal is, you know, it's a center of a lot of culture, a lot of queer culture, and I'm happy that I get to be a part of that too here.
Yeah, it's definitely like one of the big cities where people come to explore their queerness, you know, and their artistry and things like that. And picking up on what you were saying, I think I've also, as a Gentile person, I've also never lived in a city that has like such an interesting history with Judaism, and like a very active and present, you know, Orthodox community in Outremont. Mm-hmm. And I'm from Vancouver, BC, and that just, you know, there is a Jewish population out there, but it's maybe not one that, like, besides, like, friends growing up, that, like, I really was able to interact from.
Yeah, I was prior to living in Montreal, I was living in southern Alberta, which is kind of nicknamed the Bible Belt of Canada, and my access to other Jewish people was pretty limited. I lived in southern Alberta with my family for about 10 years, around 10 years, and before that I was actually born in the UK. So I was born in Manchester, England, and immigrated around the age of 10 to Canada. And my mom grew up Jewish at a poor Jewish family in Manchester. And a lot of my relationship before moving to Montreal was with the Jewish community was in Manchester and with my mom's side of the family growing up, going to her parents' place for Passover, because in my actual household, we didn't actually practice Judaism since my mom had left the faith at the age of 16 and converted to Mormonism, where she later met my dad and they married and had 7 kids, and I'm number 6 in that mix. Yeah, it kind of, I grew up in a mixed faith household where, you know, I learned about my Jewish heritage, but we practiced Mormonism. That was a very intense, upbringing, especially when it came to a head when I, you know, I came out at the age of 16 and my family wasn't very thrilled about it. And there's a lot of tension and heartache and stuff that a lot of people go through when they have conflicting religious and personal views. And I had made a decision to leave the Mormon faith. And for many years after that, I stayed away from religion. And it wasn't until I was in my early 20s till I showed an interest in Judaism and my mom's side of the family and started to learn more about Jewish faith and culture. And I was really, I found a peace with it. And I found that sense of identity that you feel you lose when you are, you know, ostracized from your community. And it was liberating in a way, because I didn't really have to commit. It was on my own terms this time. And then as you kind of get more into the Jewish faith, you start to understand that there's more to it than just holidays. There's more than just food, and there's politics too, and there's a whole history there, and that was kind of that was the harder part, I think.
What made that hard specifically? Your relationship to the political aspects of Judaism.
I think because I didn't understand to begin with. I felt like I didn't feel legitimate in a sense where I didn't feel like I grew up with it, and I feel like it was difficult in the sense that like. I just want to kind of preface this and say I speak from a place of personal experience and with a totally open mind too, and I seek to learn and be corrected when necessary too, but I definitely what I know is from my own life and through the stories that I hear from my family and these are my stories too. Even talking about it now is a bit hard because I think it's difficult because like any religious I think my access to information resources were pretty muddled at the time. And a lot of what you're told about Jewish culture, Jewish faith is based on either stereotypes or like more of a modern view of what it means to be Jewish in like the Western sense. And I didn't feel like I really fit in with a lot of that because, you know, I never had a bar mitzvah or I never learned to sing the songs. And but still I wanted to learn, you know, and I still do. But I think as far as politics, it is a difficult conversation to have when it comes to what's happening in Palestine and with Israel. For myself, I think I have an easier time kind of compartmentalizing everything because I don't have that upbringing in the same way that someone who was raised within the Jewish faith would have. I have friends who, you know, who have been to Israel and have had great experiences within the Jewish community there. And that's been accessible for them. And I think they're having an even harder time reconciling their moral beliefs and their religious beliefs at this time than I am. For me, it was the more I learned about what was happening in Palestine, the easier it was to relate to what I learned about colonialism in the European sense of what happened to North America, you know, what happened to Canada, the indigenous people here, because I've already like processed what happened here. And it's easy for me to understand colonialism, whereas maybe someone who is being confronted with what they feel is an accusation of colonialism in Palestine wouldn't necessarily draw that conclusion. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think about Canada versus Israel a lot, you know, because I've thought a lot of what my presence here means in like active settler colonialism. And I mean, I saw like really weird and bad meme infographics comparing the two states. I think perhaps identical forms of settler colonialism. And, you know, Canada was founded as like a white ethno state. However, throughout its history, or like in the later part of the 20th century, there's this shift in Canadian governance where it transforms into like a multicultural nation state, you know, and it's trying to incorporate like people of all different ethnicities and statuses and sexualities and whatever into the fabric of it. But I think the things that they share in common are this like forceful displacement, this dispossession of indigenous people from their lands. I think there are major differences, of course, like, you know, Israel in the past 73 years became a state at a time when like television and radio existed, and also like militarization and like weapons that didn't exist at the time that Canada first began to be settled. And also just the very simple fact that, you know, the Jewish people, you know, were escaping a Holocaust, whereas, you know, the people who invaded and settled what is now known as Canada were not, right? And escaping a Holocaust does not necessitate like the formation of a nation state in an area where people are already living, but at least it adds to the nuance, I guess, and why so many people of Jewish background and faith have a, you know, while their opinions on what's going on and the foundation of Israel may not be complicated, I think still within themselves have a complicated notion of their own identity and in its relation to the Israeli, you know, state and Zionism. I don't have any allegiance to Canada because Canada doesn't make a lot of sense, you know, and it's kind of just like a fake nation that doesn't really have a history or unifying like identity. And I see myself as like coming from a lot of different people. And I also like lost a lot of ancestral knowledge and language and traditions because my ancestors immigrated to Canada from their ancestral lands, right? But I think like that's what I like, I think through when I think about, you know, like I have a very close friend in Vancouver who is from Israel and he's like a radical, like Israeli anti-Zionist. And he has like the very, has a position of being like a settler in Palestine and then also like on Turtle Island. And I think he's able to like kind of think about that very seriously.
I think there are definitely a lot of parallels to be drawn with the colonization. It is, I think the interesting part for sure about Israel is the American support of it. And that's where it kind of gets, again, I think it gets very muddy with a lot of democratic Jews who support Israel, especially like with the issue of pink washing that's happening in Israel, which happens a lot. I think there are a lot of parallels with the Democratic Party in the U.S.
Yeah, I think I mean, for me, America's like fervent support for Israel across party lines is like a clear example of like what America is and what America stands for, you know, and like expansion and extraction. My understanding, and this is very perhaps essentialized, but like Israel is important to America because it is like an access point to the Middle East, you know, where America is like waging their wars and predominantly over like resources and oil. And I'm sure like the conversation is more complicated and nuanced than that. But I think to me, it's like American support of Israel is like clearly such like a colonial thing.
Absolutely. And I think it has been for a long time.
I didn't ask you to prepare this, but I was wondering if like you could talk about the text that you were reading the other night or like a week ago on Instagram.
Yeah, I think, let me just pull it up one sec.
Basically, I want to end this and like not it be just like all like, oh, damn.
Yeah.
Colonialism.
I mean, that's where I felt it was going. And I was like, I should stop talking about this. Okay, let me find this. So it's just in my book here. Yeah, so I was reading an article actually about Leonard Cohen, who's if anyone knows me, he's a big influence of mine in my music and in my poetry, and since moving to Montreal, I kind of got more and more interested in the mythology surrounding him. And I was interested on where he would have stood in within this conflict. And I think historically he was pretty, he liked to keep himself out of politics quite a bit. He might have dabbled in Zionism in the 70s and gone to Israel here and there. And I came across this article that was putting it into question. And they referenced a poem that he wrote from the Book of Mercy, which is like, it's a companion volume to his one of his most famous books, The Book of Longing, which is really great. And I think it was I was reading the what you're referencing to, but I think it puts it into context quite well on where he stood later on in life after after seeing what happened over the years in Palestine. So I can read that if you want.
Yeah, that would be great. I'd love that.
Israel, and you who call yourself Israel, the church that calls itself Israel, and the revolt that calls itself Israel, and every nation chosen to be a nation, none of these lands is yours. All of you are thieves of holiness. All of you are at war with mercy. Who will say it? Will America say, we have stolen it, or France step down? Will Russia confess, or Poland say, we have sinned? All bloated on their scraps of destiny, all swaggering in the immunity of superstition. Ishmael, who was saved in the wilderness and given shade in the desert and a deadly treasure under you, has mercy made you wise? And there's another part in the poem that I really like too. And it goes, the covenant is broken. The condition is dishonored. Have you not noticed that the world has been taken away? You have no place. You will wander through yourselves from generation to generation without a thread. Therefore, you rule over chaos. You hoist your flags with no authority, and the heart that is still alive hates you. And the remnant of mercy is ashamed to look at you. You decompose behind your flimsy armor. Your stench alarms you. Your panic strikes at love. The land is not yours. The land has been taken back. Your shrines fall through empty air. Your tablets are quickly revised, and you bow down in hell beside your hired torturers. And still, you count your battalions and crank out your marching songs. Your righteous enemy is listening. He hears your anthems full of blood and vanity, and your children singing to themselves. He has overturned the vehicle of nationhood, and he has spilled the precious cargo, and every nation he has taken back. Because you are swollen with your little time. Because you do not wrestle with your angel. Because you dare to live without God. Because your cowardice has led you to believe that the victor does not limp. And I think that's really beautiful. I think it kind of sums up where he stood on the issue, where although there's the belief that this land is for the Jewish people, at what cost do you take it? And what reasons do you use to excuse war crimes? And I think it's important to think about these things. It's important to critique religion, and it's important to critique government and military, and even when they're your own government and military. The Judaism teaches you to question the Torah, to think of new ways of thinking, and to evolve. It's part of the Jewish faith, and I think it's important to embrace that.
That's really beautiful. I think, you know, that's something that people could take from Judaism and apply it elsewhere, you know? People who aren't Jewish, that's a lesson that I think a lot of people need to hear and to practice.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And although Judaism is a very old religion, it's ever present and it's therefore ever changing.
That's really beautiful too. Do you have any closing thoughts? I know we've kind of jumped from like one thing to another.
We have. I kind of there were a few points I wish I was a bit more articulate on, and I ran out of steam on them because I got a bit emotional.
No.
I want to say something that's a bit more uplifting.
Maybe like tenets of the faith, or that you interpret to be like core things that are important to you. I don't know.
I guess a big way that I've tried to connect more with the faith is through food. And that's been a big joy of mine over the past few years. It's actually been my my main source of income has been cooking, and I found so much joy in discovering cuisine from, you know, different areas of the world that are a part of Jewish culture. Food, I feel, always brings you closer to that. I think it's also super important to recognize where it is shared in other cultures too. For instance, hummus is something that is familiar with a lot of, you know, Middle Eastern Jews, and my partner is, his family's from the Middle East too. He's part Lebanese and part Egyptian, part Greek. And he grew up with all these different foods from that part of the world, and things like baba ganoush, hummus, and tahini, things that are new to me, because I grew up in England where the cuisine is, it's not quite the same, you know?
Bangers and mash.
It's a little bit more baked beans than baba ganoush. But I feel like, even though that's not necessarily like what I grew up with, that's not necessarily my ethnicity in that sense, I feel connection to it, and I feel like I'm able to share this this joy of food and learn about it and appreciate the similarities in different cultures throughout the Middle East, Northern Africa, and even towards Eastern Europe, where my family is from. I had a roommate who was very kind and almost instrumental in my discovery of food in this way. She bought me a Jewish cookbook, and it's really nice, and it goes into the story about all the different things in the book. And yeah, it's really beautiful. And I think that's true of any culture. I think connecting with your food is the first way to discover and share with other people what you discover.
I think that's a great way to end it.
Yeah, I think so too. It's a bit more fun than something.
So. Hey, I mean, it's not fun, but it's here, right?
I feel like that's just who I am as a person. I'm either like really intense, or like I'm like, here, eat this thing I made.
All the ones you love, but I've been lost and lost 100 times before. I wash the words off the map, the ones you hate so much. You told me I've been losing my touch. I think you keep your colors every time you die. Sometimes they get brighter if you really try. Strangers kissing friends, mostly girls I knew. Loving everything, everyone except myself and you. You listen to my song in a dream I had. Sounded lost, but it wasn't bad. Who's afraid to lose all the ones they love? I've been lost and lost 100 times. Oh God, I think you keep your colors every time you die. Sometimes. sometimes they get brighter if you really try. Kissing strangers, kissing friends, most of the girls I knew. Loving everything, everyone except myself and you. Kissing strangers, kissing friends, mostly the girls I knew. Loving everything, everyone except myself and you.
The People's Sound is calling. The Suwanee Perry Pupalo Music Festival is back and online with free jazz, noise, punk, new music, spoken word, electronic, avant-rock, sound art, and dance parties. Over 60 artists performing from Montreal, Chicago, Philadelphia, Sioux Lookout, Toronto, Mexico City, Brussels, Berlin, Tehran, Kampala, and Nairobi. Heed the call between June 3rd and 21st at suwanneeperrypupalo.org.
This is Dragonroot Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal.
Welcome to Dragonroot Radio, feminist waves brought to you by CKUT and the Center for Gender Advocacy.
The Dragonroot Media Collective aims to bring you feminist content that challenges interlocking systems of oppression and makes space for voices systemically silenced. Dragonroot understands media as being inherently political and emphasizes media skill sharing as a form of resistance.
We meet every other Wednesday at 6 p.m. at the Center for Gender Advocacy and welcome anyone interested in learning or producing feminist media to join. No skills required.
You're a silent forest, you're a wild flower, you've been moving back.